You're listening to the Alex Wolf Podcast. Interesting conversations about innovation, economics, culture, and history for the independent thinkers and curious minds. I'm your host, Alex Wolf.
Hey, y'all. Thank you for tuning into this episode of the Alex Wolf Podcast. And today I am asking the question, are millennials the dumbest generation? Obviously, that is kind of a clickbaity type of question, but it actually has a really fascinating answer that I'm hoping to explore in this kind of deep episode. So this question is inspired by a man named Mark Byerlin. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce his last name, but he wrote a book called The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. That is a very long subtitle, but that is the name of the book. And I actually first saw this book in Barnes & Noble years ago. I want to say it was like in the beginning of my 20s, my entrepreneurial journey, and I totally overlooked it. I actually didn't just overlook it. I was highly offended by the title because I couldn't believe that older generations actually thought we were dumb. Like, I just was like, wow, you really have to be a hater to hate on millennials, right? Because I was under this impression that we were kind of the smartest. We were the ones who figured out this whole thing as far as like creating a lifestyle that, you know, at the time it was like sexy to be like, you know, millennials, we don't care about mortgages. We want to be digital nomads. And like, we don't want to be trapped by car payments and house payments. And we kind of had started to abandon these stationary lifestyles, typical American lifestyles, traditional kind of like in our eyes, for many of us, I think still, and especially at the time, all these ideas of that like typical American lifestyle was like, you know, it felt like it was a weight, and just everything, marriage, everything, it was just like, we are free. You know, we had made the world a place where you could build a company from your phone. Like, so needless to say, this is what I call peak millennial ignorance. And I think it's just young people's ignorance. I think it's typical American youth ignorance. I think we all kind of go through it. And ignorance, people hear that word and think of it as like a negative thing. And it definitely can be, but ignorance is just a different pronunciation of ignorance, which means you are literally ignoring something in your peripheral. You cannot see the information or the wisdom beyond your point of view. And that's what makes it a pretty scary place to be. And so when I say this is peak millennial ignorance, it's peak millennial ignorance. It's a very narrow perspective about, you know, who I was as a millennial, what the millennial generation is, and just a very, yeah, again, naive to think like, well, of course we figured it out because it feels good in this moment of my early 20s. Usually that's very tip, again, that's how many younger people feel, and we've all been through this cycle of life of, you know, older people warning us or trying to play us, like give us some play or give us some wisdom, and us feeling like, you know, your input is no good here. Like, I'm actually smarter than you. That is a very typical power dynamic that I am completely fascinated by and which we will be diving into very much in this episode. So, yeah, I just skimmed right over it. I laughed. I felt pity, honestly, for this writer. I couldn't believe someone went out of their way to write a book, in my opinion, just hating on millennials. And I was like, all right, whatever, snooze, you lose, like, smell you later, loser. Like, it was that kind of vibe. And then, of course, like, I went through the tumble of life and I started my company, blah, blah, blah. And then once I had sold it, I was really just, I spent like years just doing lots of research. I'm still doing lots of research. But one of the particular topics that I was focused on was studying generational differences, particularly like the recent ones, right? And by that time, this was at this point, maybe 5 or 6 years later, I was a completely different person. I was obsessed about learning what nuanced differences we had as generations, because I was very clear that these differences were deeply based in tech philosophy and how those generations, how different generations interact with media. Like once I started to become sensitive to what really makes a generation, the differences, the things that give us our unique identifiers very much come down to what technology was accessible during our adolescence and our early adulthood. So this book had a whole new meaning just a few years later. And I am here to say that I am completely grateful for this book. It was extremely enlightening, and I do encourage you, if you are into this topic, to read it, because I am so, again, just humbled and appreciative that someone put in the work to research and to intellectually analyze this very important topic on the kind of like scale of just culture, of pop culture, of livelihood, of meaning. And yeah, it just humbled me. So this book obviously got on the queue, and it humbled me on like a 1984 Brave New World level. It's so rich in data, it's so rich in research and just beautiful logic. And I realized this wasn't just some bitter boomer's opinion. This was a well-crafted theory and well-crafted hypothesis, and really a sincere cautionary tale about the intelligence level of young Americans dwindling, and largely because of internet use. And the book itself came out in 2009, and it says, as I mentioned, don't trust anyone under 30. So according to him, millennials are anyone born after like 1979, and there's different thoughts on when the millennial generation starts. Some people estimate it it starts around 1980 or 81, but I have heard of people identify as zillennials, which is like an X, and then millennials, which are people who are like on the cusp of Gen X and millennials, and they were slightly more developed as the internet spread, and they tend to relate more to the millennials than the Gen Xers in some regards. And just so you're kind of familiar with these terms, if you don't know them, millennials are obviously my generation, between like 1980 to like 1994-ish. But before that, we had Generation X. And then before that, we had the boomers. After the millennials, we have Gen Z, who is hot on the market right now. And after that, I don't know if we've officially coined the term for the generation after. I've heard like Gen Alpha. We're going to kind of start the alphabet over again. So it might be like a Generation Alpha or something like that. But anyway, what's so interesting is that the truth is generations are not official lines, right? They're not official things. They don't have official boundaries. We only can use qualitative and cultural data to categorize what makes a quote unquote generation, right? We can only use kind of just our judgment to identify what makes us united as a generation. And it's usually through the very disposable and changing entertainment industry. So music, film, fashion. But of course, what is responsible for how the music, film, and fashion is distributed and even just made, right? How the music sounds, how the film looks, how the fashion looks, all of that is through whichever advancements in technology were at the time. So people think, oh, you know, what makes us as a generation is we all grew up listening to Jay-Z or we all grew up listening to Slick Rick. Well, part of why you even were able to listen to those artists is because there were certain music players, right? And the medium of those music players had a tremendous influence on what the music was, what it was about, how it sounded when you listened to it. Back in the day, you had to kind of just wait for songs to come to you through the radio. It wasn't this on-demand experience. It was also more of a collective experience. You were more likely to hear music at parties or concerts, but not just chilling in your own home, right? And that can be a whole episode as far as each of these things that make our culture, again, must be first distributed through whatever advancement in technology is available at the time. When cavemen were using drums, guess what? You know, that's what unified those generations, or whatever instruments were invented in the 16, 17, 18, 1400s, right? So that's why it's important to look into the tech philosophy, because you see how people of the time were thinking through whatever instruments, both musical or just any technological instrument, and how it just performs, what it's about, what sound it makes, what, you know, what was the social climate at the time for people to crave this type of beat, this type of genre, right? You think of hip hop as a very popular and recent example. Hip hop was birthed out of the concrete. It was birthed out of the poverty of the Bronx. It was a sound of empowerment that was needed. And so all of these things factor in to to culture and generations. So that's very important to note. I think another important thing to note here is because people are saying things like, oh, generations used to be 10 years long. Now they're starting to be 3 years or 5 years. Well, that's it. That fits in with this idea that what makes generations is not like a particular amount of years. It's really how quickly technology changes, because the more tech is changing, the more that the distribution of the music, film, fashion, arts change. And so that means also back in the day, generations might have lasted longer because the tech wasn't changing as rapidly, or, you know, or in different countries or traditions where the tech doesn't change as much. And basically, the difference between a child born today in one of these less technologically focused societies and a child born 50 years ago, it's not that different, because their environments are pretty much the same. And as you know, and as I've talked about, environments control and influence our behavior more than anything else. So this is so fascinating, because it shows how much generations are an artificial construct, right? There are literally societies where for over 100 years, everybody's kind of the same, you know, not in like a monotonous, sad way, but just like the cycle of life is a little bit more consistent, versus here, you can hardly, you know, have a conversation with your little brother before you start to feel like a grandma, let alone your actual grandma or your actual parents, because the stuff is shifting so quickly. And it's causing what I call intergenerational comprehension gaps, which we're going to talk about, because those are severe threat to the fabric of civilization in my tech philosophy opinion. That those gaps are where meaning gets sucked in and, you know, is liable to never be found again, or only to be found through learning things the hard way. So, again, a child born in a technophiliac culture, which means a culture that is very tech obsessed, will have almost an entirely different life than one born 50 years ago. And that's a really wide gap. We don't have to go that wide. Again, someone born in 2000 versus someone born in 1990 are going to have completely different lives. Okay. All because of the tech, y'all. Now, some people might hear that and be like, what's the big deal? Technological advancements are like the, you know, the is a sign of progress. Well, we'll talk about that in this episode, okay? Because people get really defensive. People really get sensitive when they hear someone criticize the advancement of technology because they think that, I don't know, that they want everyone to just live in the caveman ages. But I have an Amazon Prime account, and you can be rest assured that I'm not trying to take it there. So anyway, a child born in a technophiliac culture today and one born 50 years ago, their whole lives will be different. What do I mean? What I mean is that they will eat different food because, again, whatever technology is available will influence the farming industry, the supermarket industry, if there is one, right? There was a time where you couldn't even go to the supermarket. So that all influences what you eat. Well, damn, what you eat influences pretty much everything. It influences your weight, your health, your brain cognition, your genes, you know what I mean? Like all of those things have deeply influential impacts on you. So that's one. Another thing, obviously, is that they will have a different media climate. I've talked about in the past how most of our grandparents don't have thousands of pictures of themselves, let alone hundreds. They might have maybe a dozen, right? I don't know how old you are, but I'm just saying, like, for most of us, for millennial grandparents, they don't got what we got. Their media climate was very different. That and media climate affects your imagination. It affects how you see yourself. It affects how you see others. It affects how you understand status. It affects how you understand the meaning of life. It affects how you understand politics, right? So you and your grandma grew up in two completely different media climates, and y'all were both eating completely different foods. Okay, we're going to keep going. Someone born 50 years ago, and at this point, like for millennials, this could just be your parents. We don't have to go as far as back as grandparents, right? They had different hairstyles and different clothing. People look at the old footage and old pictures and they're like, oh, wow, you know, I missed this and I missed that. And one of the things that always sticks out to me about hair and clothing from the era in which my parents and my grandparents came out of, they're 10 times more quality. And that's, again, because at the time, and I have a whole episode about this, there was a particular standard in how clothes were made and what fabrics were used, in the fact that you didn't just have the ability to just go to the mall and buy another cheap outfit. You kind of really had to make your clothes last. You had to make sure they could be washed many times. Only fabrics that are durable can do that. We think about hair, the technological advancements of hair. I mean, just in my lifetime, I've seen this tremendously shift, even in makeup. If you look at the women in the 90s who wore makeup on the red carpet, it looks totally different than what you will find today. So again, we have created multiple different worlds on this same planet. And the only thing that is changing is the technology, okay? So ultimately, and all these things too, ultimately provide environments that have different tolerable social norms. So what is tolerable today, meaning like when it comes to sex, marriage, politics, philosophy, is obviously very different than what was socially acceptable during your parents' time and your grandparents' time. Again, different worlds. It's almost as artificial as building like a Disney World. It's that different, okay? The only thing that is connecting us with the people of the past and our relatives of the past is our blood and our humanity. That is the one thing that connects us. The reason why generational differences fascinate me the most is because they are a direct result of what I call blind technophilia, which is the obsession of tech and pursuing it blindly, meaning without foresight, insight, any sight, and just doing it because it feels good and it has a temporary relief and potentially long-term really damaging effects. And so generations, my point is that they are an invention in of themselves. They separate us from our own bloodlines, from our family, and again, it isolates our humanity into an unidentifiable part of life. And I just tweeted the other day how we have lost so much age-old wisdom that we only can see it today as a scientific breakthrough, right? So much of the stuff we're learning now was stuff we already knew. It was very common sense. You know, especially in the marketing world, I find it to be most funny because marketing will be like, people like one-to-one connection. People like when you give them personalized experiences. You know, this is what our data shows. And it's like, okay, well, grandmothers and grandfathers understood that. And I don't know why this is news. So, yeah, I laugh at all the marketing and the tech world too. Like, everybody's doing their little tweet breakdown of like why Clubhouse is so successful. It's like, yeah, if you create a platform that is harmonious to human nature, people will gravitate towards it and express their natural li, which is the natural grain in things. It's an ancient Chinese term that I have an episode about as well. Duh, it's like a flower opening and blossoming. Like, we are as natural as flowers and trees, and we have the same natural intelligence to open and to be nurtured by our environments under the right circumstances. Oh, it's news to y'all that doing that creates, you know what I mean? Like, it stimulates those expressions. Yawn. Anyway, so here's the thing. These technologies separating us. And when I say separating us, I don't mean like, oh, you know, I don't mean that in like a sad way. I mean that in like a literal comprehension gap way. If when I say comprehension gap, comprehension is so important, obviously. But why is it important? Why is it important? It's important because we need to understand each other to trust each other. And trust is important because right now, the reason why I think so many of us feel deprived from meaning in our societies and our communities is because there is no trust. It's hard to build trust when you can't even understand each other, when you're speaking a different language. The whole point of language is to have a medium in which you can form sounds and reason and logic to be on the same page as the others around you. But literacy and language is not limited to verbal language. It is also expressed through the technology. If you don't know what I mean, think about how hard it is to explain a meme to your mom or to an older relative. It's almost like there's no use because they would have to have a bunch of contextual knowledge unless they already know it, right? We're talking about someone who doesn't have the meme literacy to understand what meme you are showing them. And there's actually memes about this. There's memes about how moms and dads don't understand memes, which is hilarious. And that is an example of this comprehension gap that I'm talking about. That's just a silly thing we're trying to communicate. But the more serious things are even harder, as far as when, you know, Zuckerberg was getting interrogated about Facebook and how the people who are prosecuting him have very little tech literacy in the spectrum of his understanding, right? They have tech literacy. It's just not the one that they would need to have a high comprehension rate with Zuckerberg. And this happened with Bill Gates, too, when he went to trial in the 90s for his antitrust kind of like litigation. And it is common practice for tech companies to take advantage of this technical comprehension gap, because by the time you figure it out, oh, honey, it's too late. So these comprehension gaps, again, they're not just through language, they are also through tech literacy and philosophy. And these gaps, I want you to envision them. And what falls in these gaps is our natural wisdom. A lot of what makes us, feel alienated from our humanity and from our reality. And this gap is an issue that makes us, you know, it makes us have a lack of meaning. It makes us miss out on life. It makes us miss out on good years. Because basically what's happening is so many people are depressed. So many people are having anxiety. Like, this culture might as well be a depression factory. Like, you want to know how to make a population of a bunch of depressed people. This is a great case study. And people are looking around like, oh, you know, what's the problem? What's the issue? Why is it that so many people are depressed and have anxiety? And my whole thing is like, this is what this kind of culture produces. It's literally in my perspective, it's like a machine. It's like, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of this type of media, a little bit of this type of hyper information, a little bit of this kind of stimuli, this amount of isolation, this amount of comparison, this amount of tech, blind technophilia. Boom, what do you get? You get a isolated, depressed, anxiety-ridden young person who feels burdened and unprepared for reality and adulthood. And a lot of them, unfortunately, do, you know, opt out and don't, you know, don't want to live anymore. And that's very sad. And, you know, it's a sensitive topic. And if that is, you know, obviously, like, you gotta get the help you need if you are in that situation. But I'm saying all this to say that that is what this produces. Okay? That is why there's so many of young people and millennials and everybody who feel this way. That is why tech philosophy is a very important conversation, because y'all want to just build the tech and not question, is it worth living here? Okay. So, and that's the thing. People don't realize that until it's too late, and we waste good years. If we had less comprehension gaps, we would have a better understanding of what can make our lives feel meaningful and what can, bring that like worthiness and humanity back to our life. And we can feel that earlier. Why wait until you're 50 and, you know, all your relatives have kind of passed away and it's just you and maybe like a relationship that hasn't worked out or kids that don't really love you, and like now is when you want to wake up to your humanity. But, you know, I'm saying that sounded like judgy, and I guess it kind of was, but I know ultimately that, again, a lot of people aren't consciously doing that. They just end up being in this situation because the hyperstimuli pushes us from left to right, and the blind technophilia pushes us left to right, so that we don't wake up to our humanity until the life stage kind of abruptly forces us to see it, the life stage of middle adulthood. Because you can't really see it when you're a happy-go-lucky dumb young millennial, as my point was earlier. So the ignorance slash ignorance. So I have some material about this, by the way. I will include a link. There's a video I made talking about the gap between social technology and social technology research being too vast to afford. And you can check that out. So let's talk about this book. I have so many highlights, so many notes, so many underlines in this book, and I went through it again. I read this book probably once a year to just have a refresher. That's how much I really appreciate this book. It's so crazy how life could do a 180 on you. And so I went in it again for you guys to pick out the lines that I felt were the most beautiful and crazy and amazing and fascinating. And so I'm going to dive into them right now. And keep in mind, there are, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 major points this book makes, which is a shit ton, by the way, for a book. That's amazing. Like, this guy deserves his flowers. Like, he really put his foot into it. For a book to make 5 really good points and have research and data and all that stuff to back it up is an amazing accomplishment. And I, again, so grateful. So I'm going to name the points and then I'm going to dive into each point deeper. So the first point is that the intergenerational comprehension gap is wider and more threatening than we thought. What does that mean? It means adults at the time when millennials were young. So I need you to go back in time with me a little bit when we're talking about this. This book was published in 2009. Facebook was released in 2004. But the iPhone came out in 2007. You have to understand, just because something comes out, it takes a few years for it to warm up. So 2009-ish is when people are starting to really have mobile phones, but he's not really talking about mobile phones in this book, which is beautiful and crazy to think about. He's really just talking about that stage of millennial life when we were teenagers and we were going home and going on the computer all day long, okay? Think, you know, Meadow and AJ from The Sopranos. Those are, like, beautiful examples of millennials. So, the first point is that adults knew very little about how our relationship with technology, specifically the computer and the internet, was actually working or actually impacting us. And he talks about just like the cluelessness of the parents. That's a very important point that we don't think about. That is the epitome of tech. Blind technophilia, when parents are like, I don't know, you know, little Jimmy looks like he's, you know, learning on there, so we're just going to give it to him. So that's the first point. We're going to dive into that. The second point is that we have moved from, I guess you can call it like a critical thinking, knowledge formation type of population to just an information retrieval population. So we are less about forming our own knowledge and opinion and more about regurgitating and, you know, kind of not storing the, we don't have the need to store the information as much in our brains because obviously the computers have them stored. The third point is that there is a severe threat to being an informed citizen with an information heavy communication based society. You know, one of the beautiful points of this book is he's like, adults need to know how to be informed. And it's really hard to do that right now because we're overburdening people with information. And that is a real threat because people don't even know what is real. They don't know how to find information. Okay, the next point, the fourth point is, there is literal proof of literacy declining. and academic comprehension declining. And then the fifth point is that millennials aren't prepared to know or understand the significance of their roles as responsible citizens and adults. And that was a major theme in my presentation about why millennials feel so unaligned with their age. I know I talk about it all the time, but it's my baby, y'all. I put a lot of hard work and research into that, and I felt like it was a very important thing to talk about. So he definitely dives into some of that. So let's go into this first point of the adults knowing very little about our relationship with technology. And in the preface, the book is so good, it's good in the preface. So he says, the bedroom is no longer a sanctuary, it's a command center. Emails, text messages, blog postings and comments, phone calls, tweets, feeds, photos, and songs pour in every evening, and if kids don't respond, they fall behind. So beautiful way of looking at it. Our bedrooms turning into this command center, this like multimedia center. That's a little odd, right? It's normalized now, but why would a child need so much communications going on, right? And I'm not saying that because it's bad. It's just I'm really genuinely like asking, like, that's kind of interesting. So I basically kind of bookmarked where these points were emphasized, and I'm just going to read where they were. So he says that millennials blink at the terms LP, station wagon, Betamax, IBM Selectric, rabbit ears, and a thousand other apparatuses from their parents' time. And if they encountered them now, they would hoot at the primitivism. A world with only landlines impresses them as ridiculously inconvenient. No cohort has witnessed such enabling advances in personal gadgetry. What perplexes their elders act out as the natural thing to do. Okay, so it's funny. I don't know what Betamax is. but, you know, think about how yeah, these are all old technologies. LP, station wagon, IBM Selectric. We don't know what those terms are. We snub our nose at them. And we are now old enough that we have terms where Gen Z would snub their noses. But I think, again, the beautiful point here is that he's pointing out how at this time, in 2009, we viewed these things as ridiculously inconvenient, and again, no cohort has witnessed such enabling advances in personal gadgetry. Beautiful way of saying that. Some other things that were pointed out that illustrate this point is the total amount of leisure time kids spend with media is the equivalent of having a full-time job, and I highlighted that and put right next to it because it is. Now, we know there's plenty of statistics that show our embarrassing amount of use on social media. But the way that he says it's equivalent to a full-time job is interesting, because when I hear that, I think about the fact that in a certain perspective, we do work for Instagram. We do work for Facebook. When you are on there, you obviously are not the customer. You are the product. But you can also be viewed as like a part of why this machine is functioning. And I open up my documentary Attention for Sale by saying every day I work for a company, not my company, all these other companies, because my eyes and my attention, is a form of labor for these companies to work. And so since we're all doing this, and he's saying we spend about as much time as a full-time job, that's because the attention economy has turned this into a full-time job. It is a full-time job. We don't get paid for it. automatically, you got to smarten up and figure out how to monetize it yourself. But your role, as Neil Postman would like to say, in this society is either to produce or consume, right? You are here to just pretty much consume. You are producing by consuming, which means in economics, when we say produce, it means like just make, being able to make any product. So you make the Instagram product by working it and being on it. And so that's why it was kind of funny that he said it was a full-time job. And then you think about the poor people in media and PR and stuff like that. Yeah, they literally have to be on there all day to work. Another funny quote I think about that I said back in the day was like, I just want to work. I just want to like work online. I would just love to get paid to be on Instagram all day. Which is like, it's still kind of true, but it's just kind of funny because now the new like heaven is like, pay me to get the fuck off, right? Like everyone's like, how do I get off, right? All right. So the other beautiful quote, anything they are doing. Oh, okay. So this is from a mother in Irvine, California, who participated in the 2006 Kaiser study called The Media Family, Electronic Media in the Lives of Infants, Toddlers, Preschoolers, and Their Parents. And he was making a point about how clueless these parents were. A mother said, anything they are doing on the computer, I think, is learning. So again, you got to think about, this is, the study was in 2006, so she's probably been seeing her kids come home. And she's assured. She feels like the computer is kind of this magical box of learning, which is the way it was branded, and the, especially to parents, right? It wasn't, you have to understand it. It was not branded to us that way. And you know that because you were there. If you pay attention to the difference of how certain ads were, you know, made for teens versus parents, and the language schools would use or the news would use about computers, it was very much like, let's get these kids on there because it's going to help them be smart. Whereas what was really going on was just a bunch of entertainment, bullshitting. It was a bunch of like celebrities, Britney Spears. He talks about this. He talks about how it was just like a magazine, right? And chatting and just getting to like chat. So I just love that quote because, you know, she's innocent. Like, I feel for that mom. And there were some other funny quotes as well. This other mom says, when M gets home from school, he immediately logs onto his computer. Then he stays there touching base with the people he's seen all day long, floating in a kind of multitasking heaven of communication. Mm. That used to be a novelty, y'all. That used to be different. Now that's just normal. You know, you probably have more than two screens in your immediate environment right now that all connect to the internet. Not to mention, you probably have an audio computer who listens to you and takes your commands. That's normal now. Our houses are now obviously multimedia centers. So he points out how social lives used to quote unquote stop at the front door, meaning you'd come home from school and you were kind of done with the, you know, grind of high school. Like, you could kind of let your hair down and just not have to worry about that. But he points out how millennials don't have that luxury, how we still are in high school after we come home. We're still in middle school after we come home. And doesn't it still feel like that? That's something I talk about all the time. A lot of the platforms we use were invented for teens, and they stimulate and encourage behaviors that are adolescent-like. And therefore, we have a culture that is very adolescent-like. So he says, the teachers felt pressure to keep up with their techno-literacy. And this is the kicker for me. So there was so much pressure and excitement about this at the time before it was called the internet. It was called the information superhighway, which is a beautiful term because it signifies speed, right? So it was very hard to explain the internet to people in the beginning. People just understood it as a way for people to send signals and messages, particularly like the government and maybe like college professors. But people didn't understand what it could really do. It took a long time for people to be like, okay, I kind of get it now. But so the term internet wasn't really illustrative of what it was either. So the term information superhighway gives you a visual of data zooming on a highway. A highway is beautiful as well. So American to think about a highway as an analogy, because of course we, you know, we were able to mass produce cars for cheap, and we were, you know, the first to lay down big ass highways and rip up the railroads and build highways on top of those so that people can drive all over the country. And highways are a symbol of tech, right? They're a symbol of speed, of transportation. And so it was like, how do we get this information? This, you know, we have this big information highway, and it's really important we get the kids on this information highway, because we need to, you know, they need to soak all this information up. We're going to need them to be smart. And it's so, you know, it sounds good, but in hindsight, man, that you can really sabotage the integrity of the social fabric by overburdening, like too much information is a threat, because then you can't even navigate where the hell you're going because it's too much to search through. So this is a great example of the adults knowing little, investing way too much. This is a quote I'm about to read from President Bill Clinton, who was in office at the time. He says, in our schools, every classroom in America must be connected to the information superhighway. And over those years, over $70 billion were spent on programs that surrounded the computer for kids. I get it. The intentions were good. But again, doesn't this kind of creep you out looking back? Like, why do you even know what this computer does? Do you think Bill Clinton was really like, you know, like it's people thought that because the encyclopedia was on the internet, that we were using it. And he talks about that in the book as well. He's like, yeah, like all the information on the world is on the computer, but that's not what the kids are looking at. They're chatting. They're like doing like random teenage stuff. They're not becoming super geniuses like y'all think. The next quote, he talks about how millennials don't experience the next technology as a distraction or as a competition with other diversions. It's an extra comfort, and it joins nicely with the rest. I thought that was fascinating because he's basically saying that I think previous generations might have, because how tech was introduced to them, it was almost like expected for one to replace the other. Whereas millennials, we had an accumulation effect where it was like, okay, well, I'm going to have a cell phone and a CD player and a digital camera and, you know, whatever, like all the little gadgets we had. I had way too many. My dad bought me a navigation system for Christmas once. I was so disappointed. My dad would always try to buy me these experimental new, he bought me a GPS, y'all. And he's like, isn't it so cool? I'm like, what the hell am I gonna do with this? But shout out to my dad. He was trying to just encourage navigation, which is very important. Again, like when you're young, you don't appreciate. I love navigation. I love maps and stuff. I think it's a very cool thing. But I just remember like I had an MP3 player. I had a navigation GPS. It was like one of those ones you kind of like put in the car, but it was like a gadget. I don't know, in my life. But yeah, it was just like, let's add, or just like the iPhone, the tablet, the desktop, the laptop, which is pretty interesting. I thought that was an interesting point. Okay. Oh, this is a good one. He talks about Twitter. I love when, you know, you read about what the census was when people, when these apps first came out. He says, Twitter technology, debuting in March 2006, enables users to send short updates on the spur of the moment through mobile phones and pocket PCs to other devices or to a profile page that forwards the message to every registered friend slated to receive them. The tweets can go out every few minutes and can be as mundane as, well, I'm stuck in traffic. Stemming from the one simple query that Twitter.com asked, which is, what are you doing? So remember when everyone was making fun of us for being on Twitter? It was like, who cares about your cheeseburger? That's like the number one line everyone says. And that's what they were telling millennials. And what he says is, that is the genuine significance of the web to a 17-year-old mind, not the universe of knowledge brought to their fingertips, but an instrument of nonstop peer contact. So I have like a big ass LOL next to that. So again, what he's trying to warn people is that they're not doing what you think they're doing on there, y'all. They're not going on there and growing their brains 10 times bigger. They're just talking about dumb shit on Twitter. And we're still doing that. Oh, God. I mean, I don't know. I feel like at this point, a Twitter is just a natural extension of who I am. And it's, yeah, it's a little like sad and weird, but it's the honest like millennial thing. It's like you have a thought and you want to tweet it. I can't explain it. It's just something, it's a part of just how I like think. All right. So that was what I wanted to dive in for the first point. This is going to be a little long episode, but I love this topic so much. So we're going to keep going. So all right, the second point is we have moved from critical thinking and knowledge formation to information retrieval. So he basically says how ordinary reading, slow and uniform, strikes them, the millennials, as incompatible, alien. It isn't just boring and obsolete, it's irritating. So you know me, I love the commentary about reading because I'm a writer and I've experienced it. He's basically saying that, look guys, millennials find reading irritating. He says, many librarians and administrators have determined that they must transform themselves from book lending institutions to multimedia information centers. In just 1 year, 2000 to 2001, the number of public use internet terminals increased by 23%. He's basically saying they want to blur the lines between the library and the computer lab. But why? There was a misconception at the time that computers were like superbooks. You know, it was like, you know, computers are like a book, but better. But he goes out of his way to talk about how reading on the computer is not the same as reading a book. And that's pretty much all you need to know, guys. Like, in the sense that that's a false claim to think that, you know, oh, well, if we just install some computers in the library, then we'll be really smart. You know, obviously the computers are great for research, but people were very blind to the other side of what was behind all the academic, like, encyclopedia stuff. He says, Mark Prensky, who is an educator and futurist, was quoted to say, the things that have traditionally been done, you know, reflection and thinking and all that stuff, are in some ways too slow for the future. Is there a way to do those things faster? He kind of makes a lot of people look like a fool in this book by quoting them. But he takes those quotes, which are warmly received in the context of like a Wired magazine or a tech magazine. And there's applause, there's praise for the futuristic people and their mindsets of like, how do we just get rid of, you know, wires? How do we get rid of, like, how do we make reflection faster? Those are provocative, exciting statements, you know. Those in the context of Silicon Valley are like forward thinking. But you take those same quotes and you put them in a book like this and they sound foolish. Is there a way to do those things faster? When he says those things, he's talking about reflection and thinking. Why would you want to do that faster? That is called blind technophilia. That is called make it faster for no reason. Do you understand the power of pace? Can you look around? Is anything rushing in nature? Does the flower, you know, worry about blooming faster? No. Every season has a reason. Hunty, how can we do it faster? To me, you're asking, how do we make this song go faster? I don't want this song to go faster. I'm enjoying the song. Dummy, sorry, but that's just, there's some things that we would want to savor in life. Why don't you just make life go faster? Is there a, you know, that whole thing, living, why don't, you know, that's not going to make it for the future. Why don't we figure out how can we do it faster? Honey, you are. You're making that time fly. It's slipping right through your fingers. You're going to look up. You're going to be wrinkly and lonely. And you're going to be like, oh, shit. I'm good. I will take my sweet ass time. Make it feel longer. Slow living is about how do I actually make the day feel longer? I'm enjoying this life thing. Thank you, miraculous universe, for these odds. I will take them. Y'all in a rush. Run, 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 run. Run. God. Ugh. Okay. Next point. The next point is there is a severe threat to being an informed citizen when you live in an information-heavy, communication-based society. Again, he really beautifully points out how a strong civilization needs informed citizens. Let's sit on that for a minute. I forgot, I think it was Neil Postman who said, we don't even see ourselves as citizens anymore. We see ourselves as consumers. Like, there was a point where people would use that term, like citizens of America, citizens. Like, people really were into this idea of like, I'm a citizen. You know, citizen is a unit, an individual in a civilization. You are a citizen. You make up a particle of this whole elaborate system of economics and government, and you contribute through your reason, your logic, your values, your labor, your love. You know, we need it. We need that for this whole thing to work. And that language has become less popular. So not only was Mark, the author of this book, trying to emphasize the importance of a citizen, but the importance of informed citizens, like rightly informed, not misinformed and not disinformed, which has been the topic of discussion recently. Everyone's, talking about misinformation, disinformation. Well, that's what happens when you have a surplus of information. You live in an attention economy. Again, y'all want to act like it's surprising. How did this happen? No, this is how it's built. This is what gets produced when y'all build it this way. This is not a surprise. It's not an error. This is not unlikely results. These are likely results for this type of media climate. So I love that. And yes, I think there's beauty in kind of taking on the responsibility of being an informed citizen, even though it is very daunting in these times. So he says most American teens possess little knowledge that would make them an informed citizen. And too few of them master the skills needed to negotiate an information-heavy, communication-based society and economy. An anti-intellectual outlook prevails in their leisure lives, squashing the lessons of school. This guy's definitely big on school, which is cool. You know, he's a teacher. The other quote he has here is from a professor, highly paid teacher, some type of highly, you know, esteemed literary teacher. And he's talking about how there was a presentation called Reading at Risk. And he was, oh gosh, I feel him for this. He presented a presentation about how reading was declining to literary teachers. And he's going in there like, you know, he really wants to be like, hey guys, like, let's stop this. Let's like really keep reading alive and literature alive. And he says that one of the teachers said, look, I don't care if everybody stops reading literature, she blurted. Yeah, it's my bread and butter, but cultures change. People do different things. What to say about a hyper-educated, highly paid teacher, a steward of literary tradition entrusted to impact the value of literature to students who shows so little regard for her field? I can't imagine a mathematician saying the same thing about math or a biologist about biology. Yet, sad to say, scholars, journalists, and other guardians of culture accept the deterioration of province without much regret. So he's saying not only are people reading less, but the people who are supposed to care about it don't. He's like, oh, shit, it's really bad. He's like, wait, I'm in this alone? Sadly, kind of. The other quote I wanted to read that emphasizes this point, he says, the American Political Science Association declared in 1998 that current levels of political knowledge, political engagement, and political enthusiasm are so low as to threaten the vitality and stability of democratic politics in the United States. And I wanted to point that out because there was that year that everyone was like, how did Trump get in office? How did this happen? You know, everybody wanted to pull their shocker. They were just shocked. And this was a statement made in 1998. Okay, people were like, look, these millennials, we're seeing how they're forming. We're watching their development. They're going to threaten the vitality and stability of politics. So get ready for some rumble tumble. Okay, that is the importance of being an informed citizen. The next quote is, let's see, where am I at? Oh, this one's good. He talks about how we don't even know how to find information. So he says, academic and workplace performance increasingly depends on the ability to identify trustworthy sources, select relevant information, and render it in clear, useful form to others. Tasks that exceeded the talents of most students. So he continues to kind of make this point that to be an informed citizen, it's not just about knowing what's going on, but again, having a competency so that you can apply a skill or gain a skill, learn a skill, contribute. You know, that that's needed. And he's saying that this was a great chapter because he breaks down these students who sit down and were actually tested to see if they could find certain facts, and the ratings were poor, meaning like a lot of students had a hard time finding or being able to identify true information. knowing how to source information. And it's funny, he says something in this book like, you know, 91% of the people don't look for, I think it was more than 91, don't look for results past the first Google page, which is not a provocative thing to say today, right? Like today, that's just like, duh. But in 2009, it had a little bit more edge to it because he's like, the world is not the first page of Google, y'all. But today it is, right? Today it is. So that is, that's not really that cute, y'all. This was another beautiful point that emphasizes the point. he says, he talks about how vocabulary is learned, especially during development. And he says how most of our vocabulary grows mainly through informal exposure and not deliberate study. So your lexicon, your spectrum of words develops through informal exposure, overheard conversations, random, you know, newspaper articles, books, you know. So they did a study that compared mediums with rare words per 1,000 word. So basically, the higher the score, the more rare words the medium has. And again, those rare words are great because they develop our vocabulary. And the more your vocabulary is developed, the more comprehensive you are, the more you just understand things, even on a etymological level, knowing how prefixes work and suffixes work help you form sentences, comprehend sentences, which are obviously very important in anything, right? In your relationships, in your business, in day-to-day activity when you're dealing with other people. So he says, what is immediately apparent is how lexically impoverished most speeches compared to written language. So the truth is most people develop their vocabulary not from hearing it, but from reading it more, which is always why I was kind of fascinated by the audiobook trend. I think audiobooks are great if they work for you, but for me personally, I comprehend books way better when I can see the words. And that's just, you know, my learning style. But they did this study comparing mediums with rare words per 1,000. And the first ranking was newspaper. The second was adult books. The third was comic books, which is kind of fun. Then it was children's books. And then it was preschool books. So basically every type of book and written word medium was higher. Then after that, you get prime time adult TV shows. Then you get prime time children's shows. Then you get like preschool show like Sesame Street. And the last was college conversations, like student college conversations, overhearing them or whatever. So if you want to develop your vocabulary, you're going to want to read. Sorry, that shit's funny. Because you see what I'm saying? Like, it's common sense, but we got to, like, do all it is. Like, go back to the drawing board. Like, well, actually, it seems like blah, blah, blah. Yes, you got to read. I don't know, y'all. It's the same thing we were told in third grade, you know? And it's not just to be smart and to, you know, feel elevated from other people. It's so that you are empowered. It's so that you are linguistically confident and you can go out there and speak and listen and hear people, because the comprehension is not just so low intergenerationally, but it's so low within ourselves, within our peers, within the people who are our age range, because we're using such shitty technology to communicate. I'm sorry. It's just the truth. All right. So that was the third point. We got two more points, y'all. the fourth point is there is literal proof of literacy declining. And I love these because, you know, people don't argue with numbers. So the first stat we have here, and again, this is old. It's not like, it's probably just worse today. I would bet money is only worse. But the reason why I think it's relevant, even though it's dated, is because it's about our generation, right? It's about millennial generation. It's revealing to our development. Development. So he says the 2003 National Assessment of Adult Literacy found that the literacy of college graduates fell significantly during the 90s. While 40% of grads reached proficiency in 1992, only 31% did so in 2003. That's not cute, y'all. The next quote he has here, and there's some really good charts in here too. If I'm telling you, even though I'm reading a lot of lines in the book, it's still worth reading. It's really that good. He says, if all adults in the United States followed the same pattern, literacy culture would collapse. This is a sentence that's beneath a chart that shows the declining literacy rate between like 18 to 24 year olds, 25 to 34 year olds. So he's like, and it's consistently decreasing. So he's like, if this keeps going down, literacy culture will collapse. If young adults abandoned a product in another consumer realm at the same rate, say cell phone usage, the marketing departments at Sprint and Nokia would shudder. So he's like, look, maybe y'all don't care about academics, but if this was a business, you would be scared to see these numbers. Because these numbers are letting you know you getting out the dough. People going on to that. And it's funny he said Sprint and Nokia. These are trending downwards. I'm again, if I had to bet money, I would believe it only went down. Literary culture would collapse. Jesus. Okay. The other kind of stat-like thing he says about literacy declining. Frequent television viewing during adolescence was associated with elevated risk for subsequent attention and learning difficulties after family characteristics and prior cognitive difficulties were controlled. Youths who watched one or more hours of television per day at mean age 14 years were at elevated risk for poor homework completion, negative attitudes towards school, poor grades, and long-term academic failure. Youths who watched 3 or more hours of television per day were at elevated risk for subsequent attention problems and were the least likely to receive post-secondary education. I mean, trying to tell y'all. He's just talking about television. The last one I want to talk about with the reading. Oh, this is good. Oh, see, this one, he put his foot into it, y'all, because he has a whole chapter where he's talking about skimming. So the difference between reading and skimming and how important it is to know the difference. He says, this is funny. He says, hold on, let me make sure I'm on the right part. There's two parts here. Okay. Screen reading differs greatly from book reading. I'm going to say that again. Screen reading differs greatly from book reading. In 1997, some researcher issued an alert entitled How Users Read on the Web. The first sentence ran, "They don't." Oh, shit. That's creepy. This is 1997. The first sentence, "They don't." They don't read on the web. Only 16% of the subjects read text on various pages linearly, word by word and sentence by sentence. The rest scanned the pages, picking out individual words and sentences. Okay. This was from a Nielsen study. When email newsletters arrived, Nielsen discovered users allot only 51 seconds to them. Reading is not even the right word, he writes. Since participants fully read only 19% of newsletters. Shout out to the people who are on my newsletter. I love y'all. Y'all are clearly an anomaly. But he says that our Nielsen report, eye tracking of users reading news feeds. Nielsen reports show that people scan headlines and blurbs in feeds even more ruthlessly than they scan newsletters. They typically read only about the first two words of headlines, and if nothing in the list sparks their attention in a half second's time, they pass on. So we are a culture of skimming that's different from a culture of reading. So again, people are like, oh yeah, little Jimmy's on the computer reading websites. No, little Jimmy's on the computer skimming shit and writing texts in text messages or instant messages using the letter U for the word U and the letter R for the word R, which I think is honestly okay. But if you are misunderstood about what little Jimmy's doing, then it's not okay because you're not very clear on what he is missing out on and the comprehension gap that is forming between you and your child because this technology has gotten in the way. So the last point here is that millennials aren't prepared to know or understand the significance of their roles as responsible citizens or adults. And I mean, he called it because every freaking meme in the millennial humor is, I don't know how to adult. Someone help me. I don't know how to adult. Adulting is hard. That's all we do. And it's just kind of like, oh, you know, I get it. And sometimes I relate. But I think ultimately when I was doing all the research, not only did I learn that there is a human privilege, but I learned that there's an adult privilege. There's obviously child privilege as well, right? There's obviously adult or adolescence privilege, meaning that there's certain things you can get away with as a child, and as an adolescent, and as an adult that you couldn't if you weren't. But the point is that that's how generous this human experience is that you have something to sink your teeth into in each stage. Each developmental stage has a rich variety of experiences to live. I have a little creative essay that I wrote about how our tastes refine as we age and how that's a perfect example of the generosity involved in this natural intelligence of the human experience. Meaning that when you're young, when you're a child and you're watching your, you know, uncle eat like slimy green peppers or pickles or drink wine or beer or drink coffee, you are grossed out. You don't understand how the hell they're eating that. You think it's nasty. You might taste it and be like, just the smell makes you want to vomit. But then, you know, 30 years pass by and the next thing you know, you're the auntie or the uncle or whatever, eating the slimy peppers and the slimy okra and drinking the beer and drinking the wine because the human experience is generous enough to open up something that you couldn't have even appreciated before through this miracle of the refinement of taste. Okay, You see it in fashion, you see it in food, you see it in your taste in music and how, oh, wow, now I can appreciate this. I can hear it now. I can see it now. You are no longer limited to the naive ignorance of your youth. Your youth is fun too. We've explored that though. We know that. That is what's on the forefront of the culture. That's what's celebrated. That's what's on the billboard. That's what's in the music video. That's what's on the social media, right? And so adulthood is this like dark, scary place that, oh, it has really nothing to offer. All the jokes, all the memes are like, adulthood is basically emailing people until you die and shit like that. And then it's like, well, there's responsibility in a society can be a very nourishing privilege. You know, when I was reading about all these different societies, this adulthood was a very exciting, empowering time. You get to protect, you get to nurture, you get to provide, you get to instill your values into the world you live in. So that was something that stood out to me. They say, or he said, I have some quotes that, again, emphasize this beautiful point. When he was talking about how, you know, we're busy, we're texting, emailing, whatever, blogging, blah, blah, blah. He says, in their minds, illiteracy and anti-intellectualism pose no career obstacles. And then right next to that sentence, I wrote, because they don't. And the truth is, they don't, right? You can be just as successful, if not more, from being illiterate and anti-intellectual in today's economy, because those are not the requirements to be successful in this economy. You don't really need to be bookish. You don't need to be, you know, you don't need that amazing lexicon, that vocabulary. That's not what this system is ran on. And it hasn't been for a very long time, but I guess he's just saying like, you know, what's going to happen to this future generation of workers? They don't really know, you know, terms and theory that we need them to know and philosophy that we need them to know. And I appreciate and empathize with his sentiment, but, you know, the economist in me is like, because we don't need to know that. If we needed to know that, we would do it. But if there is a clear passageway that says you don't have to do all that stuff, you know, you could just be a YouTuber. People like, say less. I'm out. I'm not doing all this book stuff. Like, I'm just going to be a star, be a social media star. He says kids reject books as they do their vegetables. Such an academic thing to say. Yes. Yes, Mark, we do. Another quote, in 50 years, as boomers and Gen Zers pass away, digital natives grow up and technology proceeds a pace, civilization will look different. Knowledge will reside in less in the minds of people and more on the pages of websites. The past will come alive on the screen, not in the imagination. And those are just, I mean, that's one of those beautiful sentences that just really encompass everything we're saying. As these next generations pass, the technology at this rate, this tech philosophy at this rate, will just proceed. The whole world will look different. And he's saying, we won't have the knowledge, but the computers will. But what good is the knowledge if it's on the computer and it's not applied? I don't know, Mark. You know, it's funny because reading this, it's just like, well, now we're in your shoes, right? Now the millennials are in where the Gen Xers were as this book came out. And we're asking the same question. We're like, oh, okay, so we have to share this society with these younger people who we don't entirely take seriously. We don't entirely even understand. They're different than us. How is this gonna, like, how can we understand each other? Okay. So the other two, let's see. I hope I didn't lose. Okay. Now these are just like pretty, pretty sentences that I just had to share. So he says, he had these good commentary on just like the, I guess you could call it, narcissistic emphasis on our social media. He talks about how it's called My Space and YouTube. It's about us, me, right? You, my. He says that the blogs, games, shows, videos, music, messages, updates, phone calls. They allow millennials to construct a reflexive surrounding. So this is not about going on the computer and getting this knowledge and the encyclopedia and learning all this stuff about the world. He's saying it's not about going out. This is a reflexive surrounding. It is bouncing back what we're emitting. Again, that's different. People were looking at the computer as this like Christopher Columbus, oh, we're going to explore the undiscovered and learn all this stuff. No, the way, I love the analogy he says, they mirror their woes and fantasies. It's prepackaged representation of the world, a daily me, right? Instead of like a daily news or a daily whatever, newspaper, it's a daily me. A rendition of things filtered by the dispositions of young users. All of them groove the input, and the screen becomes not a vein of truth, but a mirror of desire. Woo! That's how you touch my intellectual G-spot. excuse me? Is that not so sound of a sentence aged well? Prepackaged representation of the world, a daily me, a rendition of things filtered. The screen becomes not a vein of truth, but a mirror of desire. We all watch our stories 10 times a day, our own stories, right? You've seen those memes that are like, watches my story and it's like, ah, beautiful. You know, we're ultimately like, yeah, this is not a vein of truth. This is not, he's like, yo, whatever myth they sold you about this internet shit, y'all gonna see, it's not that. Y'all gonna wait till they grow up and you gonna see, they gonna fuck everything up. They gonna, the political office gonna look crazy. We gonna have some crazy stuff happening. You know, I love the Cassandras of the world. You got to put respect on Mark's name. And he just kind of goes in. I took notes up until I would say like, let's see, like 3/4-ish of the book. But there's like, it only gets better as you go to the end, because he concludes it with just like the beautiful, most beautiful cherry on top. But he says, for education to happen, people must encounter worthwhile things outside their sphere of interest and brain power. Knowledge grows, skills improve, tastes refine, and conscience ripens only if the experience bear a degree of unfamiliarity. A beautiful artwork you are forced to inspect, even though it leaves you cold. An ancient city you have to detail, even though history puts you to sleep. A microeconomic problem you have to solve, even though you fumble with arithmetic. To take them in, to assimilate the objects intelligently, the intellectual toolkit must expand and attitudes must soften. If the apprehension stalls, you can't mutter, I don't get it, this isn't for me. You have to say, I don't get it, and maybe that's my fault. You have to accept the sting of relinquishing a cherished notion, of admitting a defect in yourself. So he's really, I mean, he's on his Gen Xer soapbox. He's like, look, y'all little young people need to suck it up. It's not fun to learn sometimes. You know, it's not fun to get your hands dirty, to have a, to develop your comprehension of the world around you, but it will be worth it. And that is what the old are always trying to teach the young, particularly in this culture, is that, yeah, you don't want to do it. You don't want to clean your room. You don't want to eat your vegetables. And because we are trying to teach those long-term effects. We're trying to instill things that will help you so that when you're 50, you don't regret everything. When you're younger, when you're 21 and you're in Barnes & Noble and you see a book like this, you have a really, and you live in a culture like this, and you're experiencing the benefits of it, which is what I was at the time, you don't hear a caring voice. You hear a cranky, bitter, you know, damn, why are you trying to like hate on me? Like, you know, you hear like a party pooper. You hear someone who doesn't respect you. And you don't want to take it to heart. You don't want to take what they have to say to heart. And then, you know, tables turn, and the next thing you know, you're talking to the young people, and you're like, you got to get out there. You got to learn in macroeconomics. And so here we are. You know, there were cultures, and there are cultures that instill a respect for the voice of the elders. Elders not just meaning people on the last life stage, but just even people who are one stage above you, you know. And so you have less resistance. I think there always is a little natural resistance. And one thing I also found was so beautiful about these societies is that it wasn't like the old just saw themselves as like this hub of, you know, all-knowing wisdom, but they also relied on the young and their rejuvenation and their spirit and just their youth is a beauty. It's a beautiful thing to have as you age. As you think about grandparents, nothing lights them up as much as babies. You know, the older you get, the more the youth in others just, you know, does something to you. And nothing, and babies love nothing more than a good, you know, than that love from their grandparents, you'll see very often. So because they're at these end points of the life stage. So I can go on and on. But I think this is a good foundation for now. Such a obviously very fascinating topic to me. Very curious to hear what you guys think. And I will include the link for this book. It is obviously in my Amazon bookstore. And yeah, just shout out to Mark B. He really did the damn thing. I just want to read one more quote. And it's towards the end. He says, "The dumbest generation will seize being dumb only when it regards adolescence as an inferior realm of petty strivings and adulthood as a realm of civic, historical, and cultural awareness that puts them in touch with the perennial ideas and struggles. The youth of America will occupy a point in history like every other generation did and will, and their time will end. But the effects of their habits will outlast them. And if things do not change, they will be remembered as the fortunate ones who were unworthy of the privileges they inherited." All right, y'all. Thanks for tuning in. Please send me a message, a tweet, an email. Share this with another millennial that you think would find this conversation interesting. Maybe start a conversation. We're in this, y'all. We're in this. We're doing this. And thank you. See you on the next one. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Alex Wolf Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. And if you aren't already, make sure you're subscribed to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. For more resources on innovation, economics, and culture, visit alexwolf.co/newsletter and sign up for my email list. Thanks.